This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey Seed.
And I'm Felix Contreras, a reporter for NPR's Arts Desk and a blogger for our jazz blog, A Blog Supreme.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia. This week,
we look at how the TV series Glee depicts characters with disabilities.
A new book reveals the history of the vocoder.
And we remember the groundbreaking career of singer Lena Horne. But first, guitarist Keith Richards worked up that classic riff in the summer of 1971 and will probably be dancing to it forever. Tumbling Dice was the only radio hit from that album, Exile on Main Street, and when that album came out in 1972, it was a fat collection of rough and bluesy rock and roll. But it was a little too raw for many critics and fans who panned it. Now, four decades later, Exile is considered a classic, and it's just been re-released with 10 bonus tracks from the archives. In two separate interviews, NPR's Renee Montagne spoke with both Keith Richards and Mick Jagger about the album and its legacy. First, she asked Keith what he remembered about the song Happy.
It was afternoon, and I was trying to put some songs together for the evening. And suddenly I just hit those chords, those opening chords. And only Jimmy Miller, the producer, was there. And so Jimmy said, hey, let's just put that down on tape, you know, just to remember it for later. And I think I did it in two takes, with Bobby Keys playing baritone sax and Jimmy Miller played drums, and that's what you got. It's the way you like them, songs that just crop up out of nowhere and before the sun goes down, it's in the can, you know.
The lyrics on this one, I never kept a dollar past sunset, it always burned a hole in my pants. You never made a school mama happy, never blew a second chance. Those are just coming to you? They just arrive?
A lot of them, yeah. You can start off with one line and you've got maybe 2 seconds to come up with another one. I mean, you're bypassing the thought process, you know, and you're just seeing what comes out. I mean, if it doesn't work, then you just, you know, rewrite. A lot of time you want to do these things on a knife edge. You know, you really do not know what you're going to say next. And it saves a lot of paper.
Later, she asked Mick Jagger about the process of getting back into that headspace of 1971 to come up with some lyrics for some tracks that hadn't really been completed.
For the re-release of Exile on Main Street, the Rolling Stones went to the archives and searched through a trove of old tracks and outtakes. Some didn't even have lyrics, which allowed Mick Jagger, basically, to fashion new songs out of 40-year-old tunes. Like this one, Plundered My Soul, which is one of 10 bonus tracks. Can you believe it?
When I started looking at this unreleased material, like the track Plundered My Soul, you know, I was quite impressed by how together the band was on something that was actually an outtake. Because on outtakes, quite often, think about stuff you haven't used. It's very unfinished, just a bit slovenly. So though it was a relatively undisciplined bunch of sessions, when we actually got into the sessions, I think the playing was quite disciplined.
Reworking this old material, my understanding was that you had to completely write new lyrics for Following the River.
You'll probably forget me, and I'll fade back in the fall.
The lyrics are quite reflective, and you know, I don't know, you might not accept these adjectives, but let me give them to you a little, you know, wistful, even elegiac.
It's what they call in the business a kiss-off song.
Yeah, but it's so beautiful. I would love to be kissed off like that.
Yes, it's a regretful goodbye. You know, it's not a nasty goodbye. It's saying goodbye and knowing you're going to miss her, you know.
I've been reaching for your number. I've been calling out your name.
But you certainly have embodied on any number of classic songs the very non-regretful goodbye. The very, you know, yesterday's papers sort of goodbye.
No, that's very kind of early. That's very cut and dry and teenage stuff.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if this is a sort of a bundle of emotions that in these lyrics, or even in the way you sang the song, that you would have or even could have tapped back in 1971, or does this, is this the sum of 40 more years?
Well, yeah, obviously, yes, is the answer. I obviously writing from today's perspective, I can only write from today. However, having said that, it's not that much different in sort of tone or thing from Angie, in a way, which is another Kiss-Off song, actually. And I actually, until we started talking about this just now, I never even thought of comparing them. But lyrically, I mean, I don't think musically it's anything like it, but I suppose a bit like it.
It's kind of cool to pull the curtain back on something like that, especially for fans who are really into the music, because I've always wondered why Keith sang the lead on Happy, but apparently it's because he was the only one there. Just this week, I happened to be interviewing Don Was for a separate story, and he produced the recreated tracks, and he said that it was quite an experience to go through and get everybody back into that space, especially Mick, and writing some of those lyrics and coming up with that stuff. And apparently only Charlie Watts is the one who's able to hear the difference in voice between Mick back then and Mick now. They fooled everybody else except Charlie Watts. You can hear the full interviews and hear another interview about Exile on Main Street with producer Don Was at npr.org/culturetopia.
Most fans agree the TV series Glee is terrific, but they don't agree on whether it makes sense that the character Artie, who uses a wheelchair, is played by Kevin McHale, who is not disabled. Recently, the show featured a young actor who does use a wheelchair, both on and off the set. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has this report.
Earlier in the season, one of the biggest challenges in Glee was how to get choir member Artie Abrams to the all-important sectionals competition.
The school won't pay for the special bus we need to take Artie in his wheelchair with us to sectionals.
What?
Teacher Will Schuster, played by Matthew Morrison, wanted all his students to understand the obstacles Artie faced daily. So Mr. Shu gave them an assignment.
For the next week, each of you is going to spend 3 hours a day in a wheelchair.
Of course, in the end, the kids not only understood, their competition number included a Tina Turner classic with everybody in wheelchairs. Actor Kevin McHale only uses a wheelchair for his role as Artie. He's not disabled, but Zach Weinstein is. And as soon as he heard about a guest part for a disabled actor on Glee, he wanted it.
The part was written as a character who has a spinal cord injury very similar to mine, so I can relate directly to it.
Weinstein has been acting since he was 4. He was majoring in theater at Skidmore College. When he was 19, a freak canoeing accident made him a quadriplegic. After a year off, he returned to Skidmore in a wheelchair, graduated with a degree in theater studies, and headed for L.A., where he was thrilled to land a part in Glee.
It's a guest starring role on one episode, and I got the audition, and I did pretty well in the audition because I got the part.
It doesn't bother Weinstein that Glee regular Kevin McHale doesn't use a wheelchair in real life.
People who have disabilities or who use wheelchairs who could still conceivably play that part should have the equal opportunity to audition for those roles as well. And if it goes both ways, then the best actor gets the part.
But casting doesn't go both ways, says Alana Wallace, and that's the problem. Wallace is an actor, choreographer, and dancer who uses a wheelchair. She was stunned to discover that even broad-minded producers only considered disabled actors when the part specifically called for disability.
I just was so floored that that's the vision, that we can only play victims or heroic individuals who are overcoming tragedy, you know, or charity cases.
She wants more.
How often do we see a strong actor with a disability playing a lead role, for instance, or a very prominent role?
Not very often, but this season there's a recurring part on the Grey's Anatomy spinoff Private Practice. Regular guest star Michael Patrick Thornton plays geneticist Dr. Gabriel Fife. Here he's correcting a colleague played by Audra McDonald.
When they told you that you would never walk again, that must have been the worst day of your life. How did you deal with it?
Why would you assume that that was my worst day? Losing my legs changed my life, but certainly didn't ruin it. There's a period of adjustment, but you deal with it.
Thornton's been dealing with it and using a wheelchair since 2003, when he had a spinal stroke. He says Sacharin's stories about how disabled characters nobly conquer their handicaps aren't the answer to on-screen diversity.
What I'm interested in these days is playing the lawyer, the best friend, with the wheelchair never once being mentioned. I think that does a lot more towards the greater good at the end of the day, as opposed to a really inspirational story about triumph over adversity.
Glee's newest guest star, Zach Weinstein, agrees. He urges casting agents to look at actors' disabilities as an additional skill set.
I would say if the person is seriously talented, don't think about what it takes away from the character. Think about what it adds to the character. I think it adds a lot.
And he hopes his Glee debut tonight will add a lot more acting roles to his resume going forward. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
Felix, the character of Artie, who is in the wheelchair, sometimes some of the fans have been concerned that he didn't get a lot of his own episodes and big solos and things like that. And there had been some concern that he was a little bit overlooked. It's interesting that shortly after this report, they did this episode that this week that featured Artie very heavily, in which it dealt very specifically with his yearning to his dream of being a dancer and his coming to terms with the fact that he was not in a conventional sense probably ever going to be a dancer. They were able, because he's played by an actor who isn't disabled, they did a fantasy number where he did get up and dance in a mall, and it sort of portrayed his dream of dancing with a big crowd of people. And it was very touching, and it was an interesting sort of use of the fact that he doesn't happen to be a disabled actor. It's very interesting.
From television to music, if you've listened to pop music in the past 40 years, you've certainly heard more than a few songs with a robotic-sounding voice. You might have even wondered how that effect is created. Well, it didn't happen in a music studio. It all began at the phone company.
This is the voice of power. I make it possible for you to have electric light and radio and television. I am both your servant and your master, so beware of how you use me.
That was recorded in 1920s, that otherworldly voice from the Bell Labs, the research division of AT&T, with that interestingly prophetic message from the past about technology. That strange sound was made by speaking into one of their newest inventions back then, a vocoder. NPR's Lynn Neary recently spoke with Dave Tompkins, who has a new book about the device, How to Recognize Speech, the Vocoder, from World War II to hip-hop. He says the vocoder played a significant role in the Second World War.
Churchill and FDR's conversations were being intercepted by German intelligence and deciphered in real time. Pearl Harbor really cemented that idea, because the warning and the Japanese ultimatum could not be transmitted by phone, because the phones could not be trusted, they were looking for a different way to encode speech. And so Bell Labs was commissioned by the National Defense Research Committee in 1942 to develop this massive speech encoding machine.
All right. At some point, the vocoder made a shift from being something the military used to becoming part of popular culture. When did that begin to happen?
German electronic musicians Kraftwerk from Dusseldorf were some of the first to make the vocoder more accessible through their early work. The first big hit would be Autobahn, this sort of serene journey across the highways. And the vocoder, it would just say Autobahn. this is sort of gasp. And they continue to use it in their music for We Are the Robots and The Man Machine. And it sounded perfectly natural in the context of Kraftwerk, because they're doing purely electronic music.
We're charging our victory, and now we're full of energy. We are the robots. We are the robots.
You know, it seems to me that from what you're saying, the use of the vocoder started with experimental music, maybe avant-garde music, but then eventually it moved into mainstream with hip-hop, right?
It became the voice of electro-funk hip-hop in the early 80s. In particular, Michael Johnson, he's a disco musician from Boston, recorded perhaps the first entire hip-hop vocoder album, Lost in Space, which was released in 1983. And the song called Pac Jam was inspired by his intent to destroy all Pac-Man or Pac-Man machines, because the video game made him dizzy. These futuristic sounds with the new synthesizer technology at the time, it really affected how people moved.
And also it has a successor, which is known as Auto-Tune. What is the, what is the connection between the vocoder and Auto-Tune?
Well, Auto-Tune is a pitch corrective software implant. It places the pitch in the right place on the musical scale. The vocoder breaks the voice down and then reconstructs it so that you have an input for speech and you have an input for a modulator, say a synthesizer, and you can play those notes through your voice. Auto-Tune is often mistaken for vocoder, so in a sense, Auto-Tune brought the vocoder back in vogue. But the Auto-Tune sound is this sort of has this bird-like delirium to it that really appeals to pop.
Some might argue that this robotic sound is overused. Do you think that ultimately the vocoder was good for music?
Oh, certainly. I think expanded music in terms of the synthesizer technologies that were available at the time. And what's more human than wanting to inhabit a different character? And so I think it gave artists a sort of an outlet, became an escapism, especially with hip-hop in the early 1980s.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
The best-selling author, Brad Meltzer, has a bit of a Superman obsession. He collects all manner of Superman memorabilia, he has written for DC Comics, and he even worked the theme into one of his recent suspense novels. But being a father made him think hard about that word, hero, and what it really means. So he started writing a little book on the side, a book that would include a collection of real-life, flesh-and-blood heroes that he would eventually present to his son, who's now 8 years old. The book is called Heroes for My Son. Michelle Norris asked Meltzer how he made his list and what he was looking for in a hero.
Well, I looked for all kinds. I think there, you know, at base, the one thing you need in my mind to be a hero is you have to help someone. You can help someone directly like Mother Teresa, who's in the book. You can inspire someone like Jackie Robinson. The best one I can tell you is the night I shared it with my son for the first time. And he, of course, he doesn't care about Eleanor Roosevelt or Mother Teresa. He's a little jock, so he wants to find the sports figures in there. And we have Muhammad Ali and some others. He finds a guy named Roberto Clemente, very famous baseball player, one of the most famous of all. And when Roberto Clemente found out about an earthquake in Nicaragua, he said, I'm going to go help those people. And he sent 3 plane loads of medicine and food over to Nicaragua. They were all confiscated and stolen by people who obviously shouldn't have been taking them. He gets so involved, he says, I'm going to physically go on the 4th plane myself to make sure that this food and medicine gets there. And the plane takes off and crashes into the ocean, and Roberto Clemente dies. Everyone on board dies. But as the book says, he's not a hero because he died. He's a hero because of why he got on board. So now I'm reading this story with my son, and I'm so excited that he's going to be inspired forever. And as I'm reading it with him, I can physically feel him shrinking in my arms. I can feel the air leaving his lungs because he's scared. And he looks at me and he says, this is sad. And now I'm terrified that I've kind of wrecked my boy. The whole book has had the opposite effect. And the next night, I take it a little easy. I don't push it. I just want to see what he's going to do. And he jumps up onto the bed as quick as he always does. And he says, okay, Dad, who are we going to read tonight? And I said, well, aren't you scared about Roberto Clemente? He says, no, I love him. I said, why do you love him? He says, because he risked his life to help those people. And I just realized in that moment that, you know, you can't teach about heroes without teaching about the lows. You don't teach the highs without teaching the lows. Mm. And that's the whole point of the book, is to kind of share these moments together and have these discussions that you'd otherwise would never have.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. We end this week's podcast with the passing of legendary singer and actress Lena Horne. Horne died last week in New York City. She was 92 years old. Lena Horne's more than 60-year career broke barriers for African Americans in film, television, and on stages from Las Vegas to Broadway. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, a career that began with frustration ended in celebration.
In 1981, after more than 40 years in show business, Lena Horne took the Broadway stage for what would be her most triumphant role. Lena Horne, the lady and her music, The singer unburdened herself of the unique difficulties of being one of the first black movie stars. For instance, studio executives didn't think she appeared dark enough on screen, so they went to the legendary makeup artist Max Factor for a solution.
He said, okay, I'll take a chance. And he did. He went away, came back about 2 weeks later with this makeup they created for me. They named it Light Egyptian. They took this Light Egyptian, they put it all over Ava Gardner and gave her my part in Julie that I really wanted to play.
Losing the role of Julie in the film version of Showboat to her friend Ava Gardner was just one of the many opportunities that passed Horn by in Hollywood. She refused to take parts as sidekicks and servants, which curtailed her movie career. But when Hollywood failed her, she always had music to fall back on.
From this moment on, you for me, dear, only too far, dear, from this moment on.
Lena Horne's career began in the 1930s in the chorus of the legendary Cotton Club. She went on to become the first black singer to front Charlie Barnett's all-white band. She landed a cameo in a 1942 Ethel Merman movie, and the following year, she starred in Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather. But she got few leading roles. Her activism and her friendship with Paul Robeson got her blacklisted.
Lena Horne was angry, and unfortunately, so am I.
Actress and singer Diane Carroll was one of a generation of black actresses who followed Horne to Hollywood. She says the disappointments and the anger of being the first were enough to crush lesser women.
I know that she had to carry that while trying to overcome it constantly.
If she couldn't conquer Hollywood, she did conquer the nightclub stage and television. She was a frequent guest on nearly every variety show in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Her 1980 solo Broadway show won her a Tony and a Grammy. And Wall Street Journal jazz critic Will Friedwald says she ended her career in the 90s at the top of her game.
In the early work, she's always, you know, trying to prove everything, trying to establish things and, you know, really working to gain your attention. And in the later work, she just kind of lays back and lets it happen.
So I want to tell you, I felt bad for a while. Not 12 years. Yeah, I got over it. I knew life was going to go on. History was going to try to play catch up.
History did play catch up. Eventually. Sonari Lunton, NPR News.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.